Hello and welcome to What Did I Learn? An 8-part series of short podcasts considering Chapter 11 from the book Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time by Professor Carl Quigley. My learning was prompted through membership of the Telegram-based CTTM, Cutting Through the Matrix Book Club. The powers of financial capitalism had another far-reaching aim, nothing less than to create a world system of financial control in private hands, able to dominate the political system of each country and the economy of the world as a whole. This system was to be controlled in a feudalistic fashion by the central banks of the world, acting in concert by secret agreements arrived at in frequent meetings and conferences. The apex of the system was to be the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland, a private bank, owned and controlled by the world's central banks, which were themselves private corporations. Each central bank sought to dominate its government by its ability to control treasury loans, to manipulate foreign exchanges, to influence the level of economic activity in the country, and to influence cooperative politicians by subsequent economic rewards in the business world. Carol Quigley. Tragedy and Hope, Chapter 11, Changing Economic Patterns, page 535, The Economic Factors. Analytically, a number of elements characterize the economic situation of the 20th century. Such elements did not emerge simultaneously, nor did any single one emerge everywhere at the same time. Quigley notes the order of emergence of 9 elements as follows. 1. Rising standards of living. 2. Industrialism. 3. Growth in size of enterprises. 4. Dispersal of ownership of enterprises. 5. Separation of control from ownership. 6. Concentration of control. 7. Decline of competition. 8. Increasing disparity in the distribution of incomes. And 9. Declining rate of expansion leading to crisis. In the matter of 1. Rising standards of living, Quigley contends that a rise in the standard of living today is obvious, and that such has been, for the most part, trending upwards for at least 1,000 years. Progress, while welcome, by its nature, however, brings with it factors which must be understood and accepted. Typically, in a rising standard of living context, consumption of necessities do not increase, but consumption of luxury goods do. People don't typically eat more or wear more and more clothing. Instead, they increase their range of selection relative to food items and perhaps simply go for some finer clothing. The aforementioned consumption pattern can be continued indefinitely and can involve goods within these 3 categories: A. Necessities, B. Industrial products, and C. Luxury goods and services. As standards rise, less attention and resources are directed towards primary or secondary types of products, while more attention is directed towards secondary and tertiary, that is, third level, type of products. In consequence, luxuries tend to become more important than necessities, with attention being shifted from products for which demand is inelastic, that is, not expansible, towards products which are expansible. Housing, for example, a necessity, is considered to be a product in which the demand is elastic, that is, expansive. The demand for necessities tending, however, towards being less elastic than the demand for luxuries. Quigley notes that in general, as standards of living rise, savings rise even faster, and with necessities at levels of adequacy, people then take time to consider what luxuries they will spend their excess of income on. And so, tertiary, or third level, production in luxury goods and services do not necessarily result, in Quigley's opinion, in an increase in requirement for capital investment. As a result of the economic factors previously referred to, and in the general context of rising standards of living, an economy moves from production of secondary goods and services into the zone of tertiary production, that is, more emphasis on luxury goods. In summary, an economy will experience an increase in savings and a decreased demand for investment. Next, Quigley turns to industrialism, seeing it as an obvious element in modern economic development, and describes it as the application of inanimate power to production. So what then would inanimate power for production look like? Well, human bodies, slaves, draft animals. And conversely, what would inanimate power, initially in the context of the Industrial Revolution, look like? Steam engines, that's coal, wind power, water power, and ultimately over time leading to internal combustion, that's oil, and automatic power. Energy per capita of production became the measure of progress in industrialism, and the metric BTU, or British Thermal Unit, was used within expressions of associated statistics. Quigley provides an example of such statistical expression with the reference to the United States as follows. For the year 1830, the energy per capita consumed within the economy was 6 billion BTU. For the year 1890, the energy per capita consumed within the same economy was 80 billion BTU. And for the year 1930, the energy per capita consumed within the economy was 245 million BTU. What a dramatic surge forward, eh? With the rise of industrial output per man hour in the US living standards was an additional increase in investment. And all of this under the banner of industrialism. The path of industrialism across Europe was not uniform, as indeed neither was it the case within individual countries. The Industrial Revolution kicked off in England circa 1776 and spread slowly eastward and southward as follows. France, 1830, Germany post-1850, and Italy and Russia post-1890. England had a head start on elsewhere in Europe, a situation which did not remain unnoticed. However, the new adoptees of industrialization actually had an advantage over England by virtue of their newer plant, newer equipment, and new methodologies. The advantages which England enjoyed, though, were better natural resources, a plentiful supply of capital, and a supply of skilled labor. Turning to growth in size of enterprises, Quigley observes that such was the natural result of industrialism. But a new legal structure was now required for enterprise because significant outlays of fixed capital were being made in such areas as railroads, iron foundries, and textile mills, etc. The legal mechanism became the corporation or limited liability joint stock companies. The advantage of the mechanism was large capital installations could now be formed and run with ownership divided into small fractions among a large number of persons. An increase in the size of industrial units emerged in all countries, but was particularly noticeable in the United States, in Britain, and in Germany. Quigley notes that while the number of corporations had been increasing and their average size falling, the absolute size of their largest had been increasing rapidly in the 20th century, and the share of total assets, or of total output, of the largest corporations had been rising. In tandem with this, the output of chemicals, metals, artificial fibres, and electrical equipment, etc., was being dominated in most countries by just a few great firms. In the US, for example, between 1909 and 1930, the number of billion-dollar corporations rose from 1 to 15, and the share of all corporation assets held by the 200 largest rose from 32% to over 49%, and by 1939 the latter figure had risen to a whopping 57%. Quigley notes that the largest 200 corporations were growing faster than the other corporations, that is 5.4% per year compared to 2% per year, and faster, indeed, than the total national wealth. Mind-blowing stuff. By 1930, said largest corporations had 49.2% of all corporate assets, or $81 billion out of $165 billion. They had 38% of all business wealth, or $81 billion out of $212 billion. And they held 22% of all wealth in the U.S., or $81 billion out of $367 billion. How about this then? In 1930, 94 years ago, as of this current review, one American corporation, namely American Telephone and Telegraph, had assets of combined value greater than the total wealth of 21 American states. Quigley had no comparative figures to quote for Europe, but stated that there was little doubt that similar growth had also taken place in most European countries throughout the time period in question. Next, Quigley moves to consideration of the dispersal of ownership of enterprises by stating that such was a natural result of the growth of the size of enterprise, and indeed was facilitated through the corporate method of organization. With the growth in size of corporations, it became less possible for important tranches of associated stock to be held by individuals or by small groups. Quigley notes that contrary to the predictions of Karl Marx, that is, that owners of industry would get fewer and fewer, as well as richer and richer, there had actually been a spreading out of corporate ownership. Turning to the separation of ownership from control, Quigley states that such was the inevitable counterpart of the advent of the corporate form of business organization, and that the latter had come about to facilitate precisely this. Corporatism was to mobilize the capital owned by many persons into a single enterprise, controlled by a few, and indeed ended up also facilitating the invention of various investment devices via financial capitalism. Quigley next considers the concentration of control, which he states was also inevitable in the long run, and which was facilitated to an extent by the special investment devices birthed through financial capitalism. The result of the aforementioned was that in highly industrialized countries' economic systems became dominated by a handful of industrial complexes. Examples of domination. Yep. France was dominated by the Rothschilds, Mirabaud, and Schneider. Germany dominated by IG Farben and Weringate Stahl Werke. And the US was dominated by Morgan and Rockefeller. While Italy and Britain, though, were dominated by large numbers. Quigley notes that while the ability of the aforesaid groups to dominate within their spheres of influence was undeniable, nonetheless, none of these groups, nor any individual entities among them who comprised the groups, were paramount and exclusive, nor were they able to control matters to such a degree that they were able to prevent their own decline under the impact of world political or economic conditions. In France, Rothschild and Schneider were not able to weather the assault of Hitler. In Germany, Thyssen was not able to withstand the attacks of Flick and Göring. And in the US, Morgan was unable to prevent the economic swing from financial to monopoly capitalism being forced to yield gracefully to to the rising power of DuPont. Similarly, in Britain, financial capitalist masters were forced to yield to the increasing power of chemicals producers, vegetable oils producers, etc. Quigley notes, while the powerful shifts within economic systems confirm that individuals or groups were unable to maintain their positions through the complex flux of modern life, such was not an indication of any decentralization of control. In fact, as group succeeded group, consolidation and concentration of control became greater. With respect to decline of consumption, Quigley observes that such is a natural consequence of the concentration of control. Market price competition, formerly the key mechanism within the functioning market of the 19th century, was in decline, and such decline was evident to and discussed by all students of modern economics. Quigley suggests that the decline was caused by a mix of factors such as 1. The activities of businessmen, 2. The actions of labor unions, 3. The actions of governments, 4. The actions of private social welfare organizations, and 5. Even by the actions of, and herd-like behavior, of consumers. Turning to the increasing disparity in the distribution of incomes, Quigley notes that it is the most controversial and least well-established characteristic of the system. Due to lack of statistics with respect to Europe, however, the aforementioned characteristic cannot be proven conclusively. Quigley suggests that, utilizing European and American data from an extensive study on the subject, and mainly referencing the American data, some tentative conclusions may be reached. And one such conclusion? Well, it would appear that the disparity in the distribution of the national income has been getting wider. Quigley examples the US and quotes the National Industrial Conference Board as follows. In 1910, the richest one-fifth of the population received 46.2% of the national income. In 1929, it had risen to 51.3%, but by 1937, it had fallen back somewhat to 48.5%. In the same 3 years, the national income share of the poorest one-fifth of the population fell from 8.3% to 5.4% and ultimately down to 3.6%. Quigley then states that the ratios between the richer one-fifth of the population's share of the national income and the poorest one-fifth's share increased in the same years respectively as follows, 5.6% to 9.3 and ultimately to 13.5. Looking at the ratios in the context of percentage of national income obtained between the richest one-tenth of the population and the poorest one-tenth of the population, we note that in 1910 the ratio was 10, in 1929 the ratio was 21.7, and in 1937 the ratio was 34.4. Quigley's conclusion? Well, the rich in the US were getting richer, relatively and probably absolutely, while the poor were getting poorer, both relatively and absolutely. In such circumstances, there arrives a tendency for savings to rise and for consumer purchasing power to decline, with savings typically occurring among the rich, and said savings rising out of proportion as incomes rise. Conversely, incomes of the poorer class are typically directed towards expenditures on consumption. Cognizant of the aforementioned, there will be a reluctance on the part of controllers of savings to invest such savings in new capital equipment, since the decline in purchasing power will make it difficult to sell products. Quigley tells us that the situation just described assumes that there has been no government intervention for the purpose of changing the distribution of national income as a result of prevailing economic factors. Government intervention by, for example, taxation instruments in such circumstance would serve to either increase or to reduce whatever disparity may exist. With respect to tax instruments, it is conceivable that moves could be made which would see such sharp degrees of graduation introduced aimed at the wealthy, which could be tantamount to confiscation. Obviously, such tax action as just described, would kill incentive, therefore shutting off any likely future investment. Quigley points out that the problem in relation to any increasing disparity in national income distribution will lead to the single result of a decline in investment relative to savings, whether or not there is any government involvement. The difference between government involvement or not is that in the case of the former, it becomes a killing of inventiveness, while in the latter, it relates to a decline in consumer purchasing power. Quigley contends that the controversy in Europe and in the US, which apparently raged since 1932 between progressives and conservatives, with regards to the case of or lack of investment, was an artificial one. Progressives believed that the problem was one of lack of consumer purchasing power, while conservatives believed that the problem was actually one of lack of confidence. Quigley asserts that they are both correct, as they were individually stating two aspects of the same cyclical problem. Quigley then zooms in to examine the cycle as follows. A. Purchasing power creates demand for goods. B. Demand creates confidence in the minds of investors. C. Confidence creates new investments. And D. New investment creates purchasing power, which in turn leads to more demand, and so the cycle goes. The aforementioned cycle cannot be cut at any arbitrary point without the introduction of falsification into the mix. Quigley next shines a light on how the different political policies and ideologies impacted upon the economic process by examples as follows. In the 1930s, progressives concentrated on stage A, that is, purchasing power, while conservatives concentrated on stage C, that is, confidence. Yes, progressives did, via some redistribution of national income, increase purchasing power under stage A, but they also lost purchasing power under stage C by reducing confidence within potential investors. Quigley notes that the decrease in the confidence element was particularly noticeable in France and in the US, both of whom were still deeply involved within the financial capitalism stage. Apparently, economic factors alone pushed the distribution of national income into disparity, and indeed, while government action noticeably influenced the distribution, the latter was not based upon any conscious desire to change the distribution of national income. Quigley turns to Italy and observes that the economic factors there had been free rein until the formation of the corporate state in 1934, and that government action had the effect of increasing the otherwise nominal tendency towards an increasing disparity in the distribution of national income. Mussolini came to power in October 1922, following which government action caused a re-emergence of a trend towards disparity in the distribution of national income. Such became more severe post 1. The establishment of Italy's dictatorship in 1925, and 2. Post the stabilization of the lira in 1927, and 3. Post the creation of the corporate state in 1934. Quigley notes that in Germany, changes in the distribution of national income were similar to what had occurred in Italy, although complicated by efforts to create a social welfare state and indeed by hyperinflation. An interesting and complex phenomenon emerged in Germany in the form of one in which inflation somehow radically reduced unemployment for the lower class, while at the same time contributed to the wiping out of savings of the middle class. So, here we had the wealth of the richest class rising, the poverty of the poorest class reducing, and an apparent reduction also of the disparity in national income distribution. Quigley notes that the reduction in the disparity of income distribution became greater under the social service state of 1924 to 1930, but was reversed with a surge in poverty of the poorest class after 1929. On foot of unorthodox financial policies post-1934, together with a policy of benefits to monopoly capitalism, an increase in the disparity in the distribution of national income returned, a situation which was satisfactory to the Hitler government. However, the full impact of the aforementioned policies were not apparent on distribution of incomes until the period of full employment after 1937. So Quigley notes, until 1938, Hitler's policy actually raised the standard of living for the lowest income levels significantly by shifting them from unemployment with next to nothing incomes into wage-earning positions in industry. As a result, the disparity in distribution of income was actually reduced for a short-run period in 1934 to 1937. Who benefited even more so from the aforementioned? Well, the highest income classes. How? It stopped any threat of revolution. Therefore, it was of significant long-term benefit to them. Rearmament policy of 1937 increased the incomes of the higher income group, while at the same time decreased the incomes of the lower income groups, and as such, from 1937 onwards, reinforced the normal economic tendency towards increasing disparity between distribution of incomes. The aforementioned was typical of fascist government, and was obvious not only in Germany since 1937, but in Italy since 1927, and indeed Spain also since 1938. Quigley then turns to France and Britain and observes that the trend towards increasing disparity in the distribution of national income was reversed in most decades. Although in Britain pre-1945 and in France pre-1936, there apparently had been no conscious effort to achieve such an outcome. In France, impacting factors had been 1. The increasing power of the labour unions, and 2. Actions of the government. Inflation and devaluation significantly dented the incomes of the possessing classes, while the whole level of living standards were declining. Savings were in decline and investments also in decline, the latter declining even more rapidly than any of the other elements within the economic mix. As far as France was concerned, the aforementioned situation simply became worse with the Depression, circa 1931, and even worse again following the Popular Front adoption of its welfare programme in 1936. Said decline in the general economic level continued steadily, with a minor revival after 1938, but the disparity in distribution of incomes became greater in 1940-42. There was a greater disparity in Britain, which was progressing more slowly up until World War I, following which it seemed to stabilise somewhat, but its existence seemed to have all to do with Britain trying to pay for much of the war's cost through increased taxation. Quigley notes that the decrease in upper-level incomes via taxation was overcome by decreases in lower-level incomes by virtue of unemployment. A revival of prosperity in Britain, together with new lines of activity and indeed the peculiarities of the British tax system, may have reduced the disparity in national income distribution, but up to 1943, not by the degree which one may have expected. Quigley notes that since 1943, and in particular since 1946, the tax schedule and government social welfare program drastically reduced the disparity in distribution of income, reduced investment and reduced savings by private sources. Throughout the 20th century, the disparity in distribution of national income, which had been increasing for generations, slowed down and reversed as a result of government activities. The aforementioned economic benefit trend changed, kicked off in different countries at different times, and the emergence pattern was as follows. Earliest were Denmark and France, with Germany and Italy following, and finally, lastly, came Britain and Spain. However, in Britain and France, the tendency was reversed by hesitant government action, which was unable to overcome the sag in private enterprise by any upswing in government enterprise. Quigley notes that with the capture of government in Germany, Italy and Spain by the possessing classes, the desire of their respective peoples for a more equitable distribution of incomes were frustrated, and a decline in real economic progress was experienced until 1950. Turning to a declining rate of economic expansion, Quigley observes that such is the last important characteristic of the economic system of Europe in the past century up to 1950. The decline varied from country to country, with the countries of Eastern Europe suffering less by virtue of their previous rate of progress having been so much slower than progress in European Western countries. Quigley identifies an increase in the power of vested interests in communities in defence of status quo against efforts of progressive and enterprising members to change it as being the case of the decline. Saving, however, also played a role in the declining rate of economic expansion. How? Well, for the following five reasons. 1. Since Protestant reform, there had been a strong tradition of saving. 2. There were many established institutions for facilitation of saving. 3. Rising living standards. 4. The increased disparity in income distribution. And 5. The increase in the size of enterprises, together with a separation of control, increased the amount of corporate savings. Quigley next looks at some of the main factors mitigating against investment and provides these examples. 1. The shift by advanced industrial countries from secondary to tertiary production. 2. The declining rates of population increase. 3. The increased disparity in distribution of incomes. And 4. Controllers of existing capital curtailing investment of new capital, which would make existing capital less valuable. Expanding on item 4, Quigley provides the example of the emergence of a shipyard for the manufacture of iron-hulled vessels. This creates new capital, but it also destroys the value of existing yards, which had been purposed for the manufacture of timber-hulled sailing vessels. Quigley further explains, in the past, new investment was made only in one or two cases. Either A, if the old investor believed that the new capital would yield sufficient profit to pay for itself and for the old investment now made obsolete, or B, if the new investor was completely free of the old one so that the latter could do nothing to prevent the destruction of his existing capital holdings. Relative decline of investment in respect to savings leads to economic crisis, and such is not difficult to see, Quigley notes. The sum total of goods and services appearing in the market is, at one and the same time, the aggregate cost of producing the goods and services in question. Quigley notes that the community as a whole, aggregate costs, aggregate income, and aggregate prices are merely opposite sides of identical expenditures. Oh, the dryness of economics, eh? Repeat after me. The purchasing power available in the community, Quigley tells us, is equal to the income minus savings, ergo, if there are any savings, the available purchasing power will be less than the aggregate prices being asked for the products for sale and by the amount of savings. Or put simply, goods and services produced cannot be sold as long as savings are held back. So for purchasing power to reappear, savings have to come back into the market, which, if such becomes the case, then a stimulation of future investment takes place, which, in economic terms, completes a virtuous circle. Quigley notes that a disequilibrium created between purchasing power and prices, caused by any holdback of savings, can only be corrected by investment, following which all goods may then be sold at sought-after prices. The margin by which purchasing power is inadequate because of excessive savings Quigley labels as the deflationary gap, and indicates that such was the key to the 20th century economic crisis and one of the three central cores of the whole tragedy of the century. And there's more. Much more. Why not check out the Alan Watt CCTM channel on YouTube, where Melissa regularly presents Redux material from the late great Alan Watt, and in addition presents her own ever-interesting real history programs. In addition, also on YouTube, you have the very excellent Hayes Reviews channel, where you can enjoy full online readings and genial host interactions relative to a huge range of truly significant books. Books which reveal truth relative to history from the very pens of movers and shakers of bygone eras. They may be gone, but to this day, we are living a dark legacy of their anti-human plans and schemes, which are being actualized by their intergenerational ideological devotees and collaborators. I hope you have found the information which was presented here to have been both interesting and indeed educational. Thank you for your time and attention, and please do check out the other 7 podcasts in this mini-series.